Hello, everyone. I'm Kathleen Francis, the host of Wise Women. My wonderful guest today is Dr. Jean Bolin. Jean, thank you so much for coming on to the show today.
Well, it's a spontaneous event.
Yes.
And when I get interviewed in these sort of spontaneous ways, I think about it's sort of like the potential dandelion effect. You blow ideas and feelings and stories out.
I can't wait.
Lands on some fertile souls.
That's so well spoken. I watched a good deal of your videos online and was so very inspired by your wise words, which of course is what we want to bring forward to, according to Gary, what he wanted as a purpose for this Wise Woman series was to inspire the younger women who are coming up in the ranks, and perhaps from the wisdom that we can deliver to their consciousness, empower them in ways that perhaps we were not. I can tell you many stories of disempowerment in my early years when some of the insults were just astonishing to me. So, you know, your early years at Roshi Joan Halifax, we seem to have a consistent event early in our lives that forms the direction of what we do with the rest of our lives. And I know when I watched so many of the beautiful videos, your gratitude for being able to live your life in a full way was so so heartwarming and inspiring to watch. And I know that very dear in your heart is the importance of bringing the full potential of who we are into its full blossoming. And most certainly you have done that in your life. And I also watched you on TED Talks, and you were talking about your elderly years and that you're not done yet. I loved your spunkiness. So what would you advise for our listeners? What tools would you think important for them to reach that becoming fully who we are?
Well, one thing is if you are in the second half of life or the last third or the last fourth of your life and you're still here, then you still must have energy or ideas or something that you could contribute, basically, to step into the sense of, you know, you've been around the block as you get older. You've seen a lot, you've learned a lot. What can you pass on, really? And what can you do now that could make a difference when global warming is coming in? And maybe we as humanity only have decades to go. So maybe it is the wise women who are here now and the younger ones who are getting wisdom earlier in life that will make all the difference, there is. So that's one of the thoughts of mine going on.
I think that's wonderful. And I know I was very involved in the Human Potential Movement in the 70s in Los Angeles. And I was, part of the EST movement, summit workshops, the Actors Institute. And those were driven with that make a difference theme.
And remember that.
Yes. In fact, I think that it really was Werner Erhard that, you know, that brought that phrase into, the current conversation, making a difference. And suddenly all of the, the billboards advertising shoes and whatever was about making a difference. But at that time, I was on the board for the Hunger Project. I don't know if you ever were familiar with that, but the objective there was to end hunger in our lifetime. Yeah. And now it's kind of looking like we're all going to be hungry. Who knows? But, the statistics are rather frightening to all of us. And the current conditions on the planet are, I mean, it's like maybe the best and the worst time to be here. What do you think?
I think that this is, I wouldn't say it's the best of times, because I think that people in general are going through a lot of hard life as the planet heats up, as the economics do what they do, and as we watch war happening in Ukraine. And we are very much aware that behind all of this, there's still nuclear weapons. So one of the things that we have really in mind is that this is a very significant time to be here now. And what often happens when history makes a shift, like going back to the French Revolution, it was like a time when royalty had, up until that point, had their say, their due, whatever. And suddenly more of the common people overthrew the French Revolution, and democracy started moving into our history. Well, we are there now. We are in the United States. To have the current Supreme Court take Roe v. Wade away and tell the various states in the union, do it your way. Don't allow any woman to have the right to have an abortion, to have a potential to shape her own life. And wow, did that bring a lot of women, younger women, older women, all kinds of women to the streets in so many prominent cities in the United States, because we had taken for granted that we had the right to decide whether, if we got accidentally pregnant, if we got raped, if there was incest, if there was any reason why this was not the time to become pregnant, we could have a therapeutic abortion. And no woman who has a therapeutic abortion takes it lightly. I mean, it's a big decision to make under most circumstances. And then when it happens, you also keep it in mind that you did it then. And as you grow older and think about, now is the time when I want to get pregnant, you worry about, well, what happened because you did it back then and all. So women who make this choice have, it's not just like that. It is a hard choice that affects their lives at the moment, but the idea affects them later on. Well, here we are within the last couple of weeks. Women cannot have an abortion in many states, and doctors who do it in those states will lose their license and go to jail. And also, we're not supposed to tell people about it. So if you are a teenager, who do you talk to? Where do you go? You don't know. And it's rather remarkable that the case going on right now is that 10-year-old who got incested, aborted, I can't remember the exact detail, but I knew she was only 10 years old, and that she got impregnated, and it was, I believe, incestus, and she got a therapeutic abortion by a physician not in her state. And then her state government started really saying it was all bad and the doctor was bad. And fortunately, I found that the doctor who was in a free state where you could make a choice like that, I don't know who the doctor was, but I admire the fact that the doctor stood up and protested that it was what it was, and he did what he did, and this is what should have been done and was done. And some legislator was blaming the girl and making it illegal. I mean, it's a horrible story. 10-year-old girl.
Wow.
Fortunately, of all cases that made the headlines, it was that one, because you can really see, while 10 is young, there are lots of times in a girl and woman's life where to become pregnant and have a child could be the end of a certain trajectory that is who she meant to be. You know, we're talking about,
yes,
earlier, the phase to become who you were meant to be.
What interferes with that?
Absolutely, what interferes with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I said, you know, the best and the worst of times. It's because you talked about this also in one of your TED Talks. On a level of the spirit, it's, I think, forcing so many of us to reach into the depths of who we are and take a stand for those things that we do believe in at any cost, and to, you know, to realize that all those things you said about the place that we are in the planet right now, I don't know, you know, I suppose Atlantis, all of the, you know, the civilizations that were at this breaking point, and how do we as individuals participate in this process?
From a combination of, I would say, mind, heart, and soul. There's something about sensing what matters deeply to each of us. And when something comes along, do we shut up? Do we speak up? Do we think about it? Do we take a stand? We've learned something of this all our lives, that there have been times when we spoke up, there's times when we haven't. And there is something about being around in the last half or last third of one's life when there's a realization that being in circle, for example, if you look back at what changed the United States earlier, it started out with consciousness raising groups, as they were called.
Yes.
We didn't call them circles. We called them consciousness raising groups. And women got together and told the truth of their lives, because so much of women are expected to sort of wear a persona and be the who other people expect them to be. But when you are in a trustworthy circle of women, you can tell the truth about who you are and how you got to be who you are now. And when you end up trusting one another, what I have been a real advocate for, and I started with being in circles myself, but circles with a spiritual center or sacred center, it's not religious so much at all, but there's something about the spiritual center that when you trust each other in circle and you tell the truth of your own lives, and it's not meant to be gossiped out, it's like what you can do for the rest of your life that is different than being in therapy for the rest of your life. Because I'm a therapist, you know, you're the patient. But if you are in a women's circle or a few mixed circles where there are men in them who are themselves individuals like the women in them, but by and large, it is women who have learned to talk and trust each other in conversations. And so if you start a women's group and you take off your persona, that is, you know, the image that you present to the world wherever you go, and people, all of you, learn about each other and have a sense of both sadness and sorrow and joy and admiration for this person that you are getting to know well. And then if you stay in the circle for decades, I've been in a women's decade for something like 30 years now. There's six of us. And we've been through a lot of life. There's been deaths, there has been marriages and remarried, other and more marriages. there's been a number of things, but we have been ourselves and we've met regularly. And at some point, when you've been in a serious, real circle, you're serious, but you laugh a lot too, because you're real. That's the idea. Be in a circle where you can be real and where you can put a dream in that you have, an ambition in, and the circle will hold it. And when it's a spiritual circle or a sacred circle, at the end, such as the circles I've been in, we often like hit the sound. Because it touches us at the heart chakra. And then we go into silence, because prayer is meant to be to pray for what we heard from each other during the time we shared our stories. And then just before we enter the silence and prayer, each person might put something in, just a line or something, that the name of a friend that they were concerned about, a parent or whatever. No big history like you do if you're in a therapy group, but you put in the name and the situation of the person that you want prayers for. And it's like there is a growing sacred space within.
Yes.
And also every time that circle meets, there's energy generated and more circles and more circles and more circles. So I wrote a book called The Million Circle, How to Change Ourselves and the World, a decade ago. And I followed it up with one about a decade later called Moving Towards the Million Circle. Because the idea of the million circle, it is a magical number. There probably are more than a million circles in existence now. But when the million circle happens, the idea is that whole function of being in circle where everybody has a voice, listens to one another, it becomes habitual. It becomes not hierarchical like we are used to in a patriarchal world. Then, or, you know, the kind of audience where there's a speaker up front and everybody faces the speaker. It's very different to be in circle where each person faces each other and each person has a voice and nobody dominates. The dream that you have of what you want to do with your life now and to get support from the circle. When the circle knows you are going for a job interview or you are going to have a major confrontation with a significant relationship, you have a sense that there are those who care about you and have your back. And every single one of them has been through ups and downs of life too. You know, you cannot get through life scot-free. You just can't.
It's so true.
But how it influences you makes all the difference. If you become bitter and defensive, that's one thing. You shrivel up inside.
Yes, I've seen it in my own family. And, you know, I know, you know, it's like people make mistakes. That's part of the process of being alive. And, you know, reaching into the depths of compassion and understanding and the humanity that we are, because, Roshi Joan and I had a lovely conversation about, you know, these things and the compassion that's needed. I always, you know, when you talk about the circles, I think that one of the things that's so critically important for each one of us, for our own well-being, is to have at least one person that you know for sure gets you, gets who you are, at the depths of who you are. And because, you know, We spend time with people, and yet, you know, many times that journey is not such a great one. I mean, I will occasionally watch Dateline, you know, to my great discontent sometimes, and see the disruptive, dysfunctional relationships that I'm sure you have counseled people and had patients that had the ramifications that were so incredibly destructive. And why, you know, when we can have an opportunity to love and to have compassion and take the higher ground, I mean, isn't that a better choice? And with those circles that you spoke about, I mean, this alone in today's series, that alone, if we could instill people of any age to create those circles themselves, I know there have been studies how women having their friendships increases their immune system, you know, brings so much more to their lives in a beneficial way than if those relationships were not there. If only we had that with the men in our lives.
But what is happening now with the pandemic and the capacity to go on Zoom circles. You can go back and remember who you were good friends with back in college, for example.
Yeah.
All over. You can bring them together and connect regularly. I mean, one of the things is people do need to have a time to try it out, like gathering together for two or three times, and then make a commitment to for an ongoing meeting, like perhaps like my circle happens to meet every 2 hours every other week, and all of us are busy, diverse, etc., but we do it, and it matters. And it goes on through our lifetime as things happen. You cannot know somebody well without realizing how much both positive and negative stuff have happened in their lives. And one of the things that happens with a women's circle where there's trust is that you don't have to wear a persona that pretends like you're not, you're somebody that is acceptable. You get to be known by those in the circle, and you are who you are. In fact, what might be surprising is there's an admiration that you have gotten this far in your life, considering now we are learning a little bit about what happened to you back then.
Yes.
And the things that you were ashamed of.
Yes.
When you talk about it, it's an act of trust, and it's an act in which you feel affirmed. You don't have to hide history. And it's once you're forgiven, you find it easier to forgive other people too. You begin to realize that life is hard at times, but if you have companions, trustworthy companions, you've got something really positive going for you. And a women's circle is what it is. It's a group, a circle of women who are have deep friendships because of what they are able to trust each other with. Their lives might be in disparate areas, by the way. You could have a lot that you don't have in common with what you're doing with your outside lives, but there's something substantially the same about, well, for example, we have in a heart chakra, which is a place in the center of our chest between breasts. And when you are moved by somebody's story, or when you enter a sacred place and you feel the energy of the place, it's interesting. Your body responds.
Yes, it does. It does. You know, and something that you touched on, you know, none of us get through this life with a bed of roses. And most of us have, especially in our early, you know, years, we have abusive things that occurred in every which way. And it is about the way we react. Now, I know in your work, your therapy that you have delivered to probably countless people, the difference. I mean, I suffered a good deal of abuse in my early years. And, my mother committed suicide, and I realized in that era, my father put her in sanitariums, and they used shock treatment on her, and she finally, you know, just said, "I'm getting out of here." And I realized that she must have had the baby blues, but in that era, they didn't know. And so, you know, I could have done the pity party. And, you know, I have other relatives that had, you know, a lot of abuse because of things that went on. And I chose to lift myself. I chose to put myself in, the personal development stuff. I read a lot of books, and then some of my relatives just decided to stay in the constant repetition of, "Oh, this happened to me." And, you know, and they, as a result, they live lives that are tortured lives because they just didn't see their way to a better life by letting go of what wasn't working. You know, if we keep reliving the abuse, then we torture ourselves for the rest of our lives. And I'm sure as in your work, you must have seen this.
Oh, a lot of it. But I've also realized that some people have gotten through difficult parts of their childhood and adolescence because they kind of suppressed it and forgot it. It's only by the time they are actually in the second half of lives in which they have a sense that they they now really are not helpless like they were when they were abused or when they had parents that the parents themselves were not capable of deep feeling because they had also been abused or neglected by their parents. I mean, there's a whole lineage often that shifts when this younger person has more opportunities and makes a choice between staying with her suffering story or admiring and sensing that, oh, I could do that too. That what you watch someone else make it, do something. And you have a sense that it's possible what she did, I could too. And sometimes it has to do with a more natural kind of flow. It wasn't that bad in childhood. It just wasn't very good. But then you're smart. You get through high school and all. You get really good grades. You go on to college, and then you are in a different sphere of influence. You're getting ideas. You're meeting people from all other family cultures and things. And so somehow there is the getting to midlife often that some people who do it well during the first half of their lives. But in the second half of life, there gets to be a kind of touching in and remembering. And also not just remembering, but the work of remembering and then letting it go or forgiving. There's something about the more you dwell with what yourself as victim, the more you become the victim that you are naming as yourself.
Yes.
Not a good story.
No. And, you know, I mean, how would you navigate a way for people to get out of what is not the best place to dwell in, into a place where they can have a life that's richer in its experience and be able to be joyful? And, you know, I know a lot of therapies just, you know, the person goes and repeats and repeats and repeats, and it just gets this groove that makes it even worse instead of better.
Well, one is that the world of the psyche is very complex. And one of the things is that the dreaming world often compensates for the waking world. And so if you start to tune into your dreams and you start to realize that if you are just staying with the victimhood, how come your dreams are not just always focused on that? And the dreams often compensate for an attitude, conscious attitude. This sounds a little simplistic, and I realize it is, because it's a little more, it's considerably more complicated than that. To become who you meant, see, I'm a Jungian analyst. Mm. It's not short-term work. It's finding out who you came here to be, essentially, because Carl Jung used the word individuation, which I translate into becoming the person you were meant to be. It's a lot easier to think of it that way. You came into the world, into a family that may have totally rejected your natural talents. And so what did you do then with that side? You suppressed it, and maybe you ended up feeling that was a bad part of yourself, when in fact, that was a gift, potentially. Or you fit in with what the family expected you to do, and you just sort of forgot the other things. Actually, it was a pretty decent, happy family. If you just had to conform. If you were a boy, you had to be like a boy is supposed to be. If you're a girl, you have to be like a girl is supposed to be. And if you could manage it, you were an approved child, and you get through. But there's a whole part of you that you may have never developed. Because one of the things is that we don't come into the world as a blank slate. We come into the world with a bunch of often deep talents. And will the family or the culture allow you to develop it? Well, often it's no. Boys don't do that. Girls don't do that. Okay, stuff it. And then you get into a culture that allows more bandwidth of who you could be and what you can do. And then the question is, will you trust yourself to take your, for example, deep artistic abilities seriously. Maybe you live in a working family who laughed at it. But what about you go to the museums, you're moved by things, you look at art, and you, in your own, whenever you can, you make little drawings or something yourself, and you begin to realize that there is a part of you that loves to do certain things that nobody around you loves to do. So then it's like, well, this is your gift. Will you develop it? And what happens when you do something you love, you lose track of time. You're just absorbed yes! doing it.
It's true.
So you don't need to have a therapist tell you what to do. You have to really listen to what is inside of you telling you that what you do when you are absorbed in it is who you are. You're becoming that person with that talent.
And then what a wonderful insight. Support,
you have people who will cheer you on, you know.
Yes. Yes, it's yes, our cheerleaders in our lives are so valuable and you know, life affirming and validating, and you know, because doubt always rests on one of our shoulders whispering bad things in our ear, and you know, those champions for who we are and who we still can become are invaluable assets. And you know, I know Gary Null is a tough taskmaster, but he always is a stand for the better of you, part of you. It's he just is that and does that. And you know, and he is also someone that, you know, he's winning so many awards all the time, and I'm often, you know, part of his staff at his healing retreats and such. And, you know, I'm usually rearranging all of his hundreds, if not thousands of awards that he has. And he says, now you understand, you know, that's so that people know that they can do that. They can look at these and they look at this and they're going to say, I can do that. You know, so it's always, you know, it's always about, for those of us that have been given a lot of gifts, if we can reach our hand out and pull others up and know that, you know, that there is a hand that can touch you and comfort you and pull you up on that next rung of the ladder of life, then, you know, then we've won in a certain way.
You know, that's true for everybody. When we come into the world, we're totally dependent. Here we are in the world, 4 pounds to 12 pounds babies.
You yes. know,
totally dependent on who feeds us, who changes us, who takes care of us. We're totally dependent. And then the potential of having active lives when we have power, we have intelligence, we have education, we have money, we have whatever we have. Doing a phase of our lives when we really have the kinds of can-do stuff behind us. But remember, not only do we start off vulnerable, but we will potentially end up very vulnerable too.
Yes.
Other people to take care of us. We could have a stroke. We have a heart attack. We could fall down and break something. And suddenly our great active self is no longer this great active self. Now, we happen to need people and need people to help us. And so this whole arc of going from of dependency through the ages in which we can really make a difference and we really might have power to the potential of being in a dependent place again. Well, there's something about just trusting that the more you can be appreciative of where you are when you are in a good place, probably the better off not only you are, but in some bigger way, it affects everything. Because right now, in the middle of a global warming, in the middle of the potential of nuclear war, if that Ukraine event turns into a global war, with all the things that are going on, most people who have the time to listen to a program such as this one. Are in a good time in their life compared to so many other people and places in the world. So to appreciate how lucky we are. I mean, I think that my own experience going way back to high school, when I thought I was a great achiever, and in my way I was then, but then I realized that I could have been a sibling who came into the world and was brain injured. I could have been him. So there's a sense of gratitude and a sense of well-being and a sense also, I think, of kind of saying thank you. How do you say thank you when you realize how much more gifted you've got to be than so many other people, including your siblings, including your people you know? You are more privileged. Everybody is more privileged in some ways than other people in general. But if you just concentrate on, oh, poor me, versus realizing I could have been that person, I am privileged. And then that kind of generosity that moves through and feels that in some way, like to be a woman in the United States right now and be an educated woman, This is a rare experience.
Yes.
You know, this idea of privilege, the idea that yes, you can put a chip on your shoulder and you know, be an activist in a negative way, or you can be an activist in a positive way.
Yes. Yes.
By the way.
Yeah. Well, you were so cute. You said that you knew and you got in touch with that little girl in you that said, I think I'm Jean the activist. And I can stand up for myself.
Yeah.
And you know that, yeah, we come in with that part that's very authentic when we're children, and staying in touch with it and developing the aspects that do make a difference. And you know, when we feel that we have made a contribution, you know, the benefits and the grace that we receive for being that are immeasurable. Mm-hmm. And you talk about Artemis, mm-hmm. the great warrior goddess. And, you know, I think that's something that my middle name is Diane. It's, of course, oh, you know, that's goddess of the
Diana
hunt.
Diana Artemis.
Yes. And guess what street I live on? Warrior Rest. So yeah, I know you love synchronicity, so I just had to bring that up, you know, so, but I'm laughing because the street is Warrior Rest. And I said, I'd love to get a rest once in a while, but that's not what's there for us right now. I think that all of us, you know, need to find that warrior heart. I know that, you know, I have been at every protest I could locally here. And so, you know, you can count me in. Just let me know if you want me somewhere, and I'll be an activist with you.
Well, Artemis, you know, Artemis was the firstborn of twins, and she then helped her mother, because god goddesses in ancient Greek mythology, of course, were not like you and me. And from the time she was born, she then helped deliver her twin brother.
Oh, wow.
Apollo.
You know that part?
Yeah, so Artemis and Apollo were twins, and she was the older twin. And so she had a natural quality of equality, obviously. And her experience, if you were like I was in part of my life, I was a Girl Scout.
You go up
to the mountains, you sleep under the stars and out under nature, and you love it. If you are an Artemis, Artemis is an archetype that not all women have. When some women are mother archetypes, they're Demeters. Some women tend to have you know, fall in love all the time and all that. And I have Aphrodite as a archetype that is just part of them. But you can have a strong archetype that you are most identified with, but it isn't all of you at all. It is that each of us has a kind of quality of different talents, different archetypes, different aspects. And some of them in certain families are shut down because little girls in our family do not behave that way. Mm. So it may be midlife before the Artemis in you comes out, but in this last, ever since the women's movement of the 1970s, things have changed because the Artemis archetype has been the prominent one. And women have gotten educated, women have been competitive, women are making a difference. And patriarchy isn't always very happy with this, but there are male archetypes that work. It is like Artemis and Apollo. You can have power over archetypes in men, but not all of them are like that either. Mm. And it's like, who are you? What do you like? What are you inside? And when do you feel most like yourself? Like one of the things about Artemis as a mythological goddess is that she didn't like being in the city. She liked to be out in the wilderness.
Yes.
And not be on big roads, but explore and things like that. It's a very, very different experience than the citified goddess who, by the way, also wore armor for the most part because she went to on the battlefields. And then she also, in the city, created practical things. I mean, there's a quality between even being a practical artist and an abstract artist. It's who you are inside and what you put into your work and what you see reflected back that you are creating and who you, so this goes back to the whole Jungian idea of individuation, which I keep talking about. Become who you are meant to be at this particular time in history where it really matters. Become who you are meant to be. And when you are who you are meant to be, there's a pleasure in learning things and doing things and making a difference. And also you kind of are aware that, yeah, you might run into a wall. It happens, that sort of thing. But by the time you've been ziggy-zaggy through life, you realize that you're still on the, I mean, I've used their circumambulation, the kinds of things where you walk on a progressive scale thing. And when you run into what seems like a dead end, it's not. It's just that you think you were just going straight ahead and then bang, but wait, that's not the end. It just turns you to take another turn. And that whole experience of walking the labyrinth, which is at Chartres Cathedral, for example, and Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, it is the way life is. You kind of think you're headed out and then, oops, U-turn, another U-turn. What do you do? If you will take your U-turns well, you can keep on your own personal journey. Yes, you're not always supported in what you're doing. But you know, when you take a U-turn and you end up somewhere different than you intended to go, think of it as an adventure because you actually now are learning things and doing things you wouldn't have done as you planned. You are in this next phase of your life, for example, where you're learning new things. You're becoming a different person in some ways, but that key part of who you are still keeps growing and to become who you were meant to be, individuation, to live the life that you came into. Suppose that there are old souls and young souls. I think you can kind of know that there's some people that you meet who really do seem to be wise and old, and there are ones that seem to be just so young. So maybe, you know, nobody remembers history, their own personal history, except maybe the Dalai Lama, who is expected, you know, they have their whole history of
their whole lineage. Yes,
lineage history. We don't. But when we arrive in the present moment in history, there's still a sense that there may be some part of us that we came to do here.
Mm.
And it has to do with the times we're in and what it is we are doing at any present moment. Do you love what you're doing? Do you feel that what you're doing is making a difference? Are you glad you're doing it? Then you are living out, individuating the path that you came into the world with, the particular talents, the particular things you learned from the life, whether it was too easy or too hard in the family life. It shaped you one way or another, but what was essentially there, that essential talent, that essential passion, stays until you can express it. And as you express it, you are more and more sensing that you are becoming yourself.
And maybe I think Gary refers to it, I think, as the authentic self. And you know, it's so strange that it's such a journey to get there. I mean, one would think that, you know, that would just be present, but so many things that cover over that part of ourselves are the things that need to be chipped away by perhaps someone like you, by perhaps something that is self-directed, or by someone that we meet along life's path that can seem a random meeting. But many do feel that, you know, there is a design that we are part of, and, you know, there are no accidents. You know, these sorts of things are conjectures. There is no proof for anything, but many of us embrace these things, as you do, I know, some of these things.
The word is synchronicity.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I love that.
And synchronicity is a Jungian term that was such a big word that nobody used it until that singer Sting came along and had platinum records called Synchronicity. And so it entered the conversation side of life. And so my first book was about synchronicity, but they wouldn't put it in the title because it was too obscure a word.
Oh, you're kidding.
So it's called The Tao of Psychology, T-A-O, which is seems to be a more esoteric word these days than synchronicity is. But anyway, the Tao of Psychology, Synchronicity and the Self. And that was my first book. And it is still saying exactly what I said back then. It is that way in which you mentioned, where you have a sense of you didn't design it to happen, but suddenly you are invited to join this, or you're just meeting this person, or you have an opportunity to do this, and it feels like a synchronicity because it's exactly at the right time when it's perfect for you to do. And you start to feel that you're looked after in some way, that there's some magic in the air.
Yes.
And it has to do with that quality that is not the linear part of the mind, the left brain, but it is that right brain, the right side of the brain that boys and men get suppressed and made fun of. And girls do have much more of an opportunity often to feel their way into that kind of world of magic and synchronicity, if you call it magic or whatever. It's just that it's not linear cause and effect. So that if you have a dream about someone that you haven't seen in 30 years, and you step on into an elevator and there that person is, that's a synchronicity, but you take it one step further. What does that person represent? It's not just, gee whiz, that's great. That's a gee whiz. I had the dream of you and there you are. But the next question is, but what does this person represent that could inspire you to take that road instead of the other road? I mean, life is full of these sorts of things that make it interesting.
Yes, absolutely. From the time I was a child, I had precognitive dreams. And so as a child, it definitely influenced my inquiry into what the heck is this all about, because I would literally dream exactly what happened in a week from now, a month from now. And I remembered, yeah, you know, that, I mean, I would find things that were lost by just following exactly where I saw myself in the dream. And, you know, and of course my family thought I was some kind of little weird witch, you know, and of course I was a sleepwalker, you know, that's me and right. Madame Blavatsky, what can I say? But, that those types of things that occur when you're that young, force you to begin to wonder, you know, what is this reality?
Right. What? And if you're made fun of and you're smart, you don't suppress it. You just don't talk to them about it.
Yeah.
Is that what you did?
I did, because I actually remember, I couldn't have been more than 5-6 years old, sitting on the front steps of our house and thinking, you know, I'm freaking people out. I'm going to act dumb. I'm going to just act dumb. And I took on kind of a Gracie, you know, Gracie and Gracie
Fred
Fields.
Fred Allen.
And my Auntie Linda had that kind of personality. And so I had her as a model for that. So I just acted just real cute and dumb, you know, and it sort of saw me through certain years, but then I had to uncover, you know, the other part that was really underneath.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know,
some people who've been very psychic from the time they were the age you described, would just see and talk to like an older brother who died.
Yes.
And I talked to a woman for whom that was very true. And so initially she just brought it up as spontaneous. And she was in a family that thought that was practically evil. So wash your mouth out with soap and never say anything like that again.
Oh my.
Well, she had enough sense to never bring it up again. But for the whole rest of her life, she had as a companion from time to time, the older brother that would offer advice or something or be company.
Wow.
And she got through life that way. So, I mean, there's something about that kind of thing for certain people that are psychic, that they can hear, they can see things. And people who hallucinate do need to know the difference between the kind of hallucinations that we in the mental health professions consider very, very strong symptoms, and they're strong medications to shut the voice of the hallucinations down, but they're usually repetitive and they're persecutory, and you wouldn't want to live with those kinds of voices. You really wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the world is far wider and far and far more interesting and mysterious than we have it explained to us as kids, you know.
For sure. That's the truth. And your wonderful insights and what you brought forward to us today, your voice, I know, is making the difference that we have the intention for this Wise Woman series. And we're coming to a close. I could speak to you for hours, of course, my dear old friend, although we just met. And I really hope that everyone will be wise enough to look at the videos that I had the privilege of seeing online, and going to your website, which is Jean Bolen, JeanBolen.com, and checking into the books that you have to offer, because I know that, you know, the wisdom that you bring forward today is certainly in the books that you've written. and the wonderful advice that we all embrace to make our lives richer, more fulfilling, and become more of who we were meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I do thank you so, so very much for being on our show.
Well, it was fun. Thank you. It wandered into many different interesting places. And this is what I call the dandelion effect. Who knows if this thing that was brought in for just a short period was maybe something that someone needed to hear. Who knows?
Yes, that is so very true. Thank you. And thank you, all of our wonderful listeners. I do hope you'll tune in again and see what we all can share and learn from each other with Wise Women on this wonderful podcast for Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathleen Francis signing off.